Welcome to Hidden Battles, Destigmatizing Mental Illness, where passionate advocates of mental health converge to illuminate unseen struggles faced by millions. Join Jeremy, Terrell, and Lorraine as they delve into candid conversations about stigmas, cultural risk, values, intersectionality, and mental health. Hear from mental health professionals and those diagnosed with a mental illness. Together, they put on the table the things people think about but are afraid to talk about. Get ready to embark on an insightful journey.
Listen weekly on Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcast, and subscribe, like, and please share with family and friends that can benefit. See you on the journey.
Welcome to another podcast, Hidden Battles, Destigmatizing Mental Illness. I'm here with my co-hosts, Lorraine and Terrell Newby. Thank you for joining us today.
Hey, Jeremy.
Good being here, man. You know, you have done a lot of incredible things with your company, IBHS. And I don't think people know really the impetus behind what makes you such a phenomenal human being, a person who is a serious businessman, entrepreneur, running an agency with how many employees?
We're up to 90 now.
90 employees. Yeah. How many years?
Going on the eighth.
Eight years.
Wow.
So you crossed that seven-year Rubicon of success, you know.
Is it four?
Is it four? Yeah, right, four. Exactly.
There's
four
differing years. Numbers for different reasons, but yeah.
And can you just like elaborate a little bit on how you got to this point? You know, what are some of the lessons you learned in life? You know, when you were born, certain things happen. And just going through those stages of life that got you to the point to where you are now.
Yeah, so I think it's first important to have the listeners understand that the way I'm going to try to do this is based off of like what our workbook will eventually help you do is have a conversation about intersectionality, which is essentially what you're born into. There are lots of science and lots of things that talk about generational traumas and generational health issues and generational things, but just for the sake of simplicity, you know, we'll stick with intersectionality. So which, you know, you're born into a certain race, gender, sexual orientation, ability, financial status, and so on and so forth. And as a result of that, you are born into a set of resources and a set of barriers depending on how you're born. And the original argument where this came from, Lorraine, what was her name again? I'm sorry.
Kimberly Crenshaw.
Yeah. So you know, she was having an experience and she was trying to bring, from my interpretation or my opinion, is that she was trying to bring an explanation that everybody could absorb, that these are just logical things that happen. And she was a Black woman coming from a Black experience. So her expression of intersectionality was from a state of being Black.
Right.
And you know, but even within the Black community, we all know it's not monolithic and there's different regions of America and, you know, immigrants and all kinds of experiences. And so she was trying to tell her story and really what happened with the media. And I'll get back on track, but I got to say a couple things is that where the Republicans and some of the right wing people have gone really wrong is they're trying to say that diversity, equity, inclusion is basically identity politics. In reality, it's generational politics. It's telling a longer, broader story, not just of the Black experience or the minority experience, but everybody's experience. And intersectionality, if you're born with low resources and high barriers, it's going to contribute to epigenetics flipping and switching and so on and so forth, regardless of race, regardless of gender. And so we get to this point where our childhood experiences 0 to 18 do something to us, whether they're positive or negative or variation. You know, there's adverse childhood experiences and there's positive childhood experiences. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those things can cancel each other out, ideally. And then how does your childhood experiences and intersectionality contribute to the areas of like vocational, area of life, legal, vocational, financial, social, relational, psychological, so on and so forth. Spiritual is a big one. So to start off with me, I'm not, my story and us talking about intersectionality, should be individualized and identity in its relation to our relationship with intersectionality and our relationships, which is identifiers, because identifiers and demographics mean something.
Right. So can you break down yours? Okay.
Yes.
So your childhood.
At face value here today, most people would say I'm an extremely privileged white male, and for the most part, I have high resources and low barriers. And in the areas of my life, vocationally, I'm successful. Legally, I've got legal team wrapped around me. Socially, I'm
But
here.
Let's back up to
I
your
will.
Childhood.
I'll back up. But look, I want to start backwards. I want to start backwards. Okay. I'm going to climb backwards because I think it's important, because when we're talking about identity politics and identity, what we're saying is how do I see you now? Which is all bullshit. That's one thing I will say.
Okay.
Is I'm not saying fair. I'm not saying that identity doesn't play a role. What I'm saying is that when I came into the room today, and we talked about this the other day, I didn't see two black people. I saw my friends Tara and Lorraine, and we got a podcast, and we're talking business and restaurants and, you know, how we're gonna do these things. The identity was removed.
Right.
Because we got to know each other beyond the identity. And that's what the stretch is. So I'm saying,
so you're saying you saw two people who stayed in the tanning salon a little bit too long.
Right? No. No.
I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Saying
go ahead.
We need to break down those barriers.
Yeah. So what I'm saying is when people see me today, they don't see my intersectionality combination.
Right.
They don't see my adverse childhood experiences or positive. They don't see what happened with and all those things. So when we get to know each other and we reach our hand across the so-called aisle, or just even when we're in business or friendships or whatever, it might start off with identity, but it can go beyond that when you get to know each other. So I'm going backwards. So started IBHS 7 years ago. I was making $1,700 a month 8 years ago, and I had went to go work for an
you
agency.
Said
$1,700 per month.
$1,700.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. And my dad actually gave me the first $1,500 to pay for the insurance to start IBHS, and then my friends, a sister, let me use her building for the first 3 months for free.
Where did this concept and idea come from? Because how old were you when you were thinking about this?
I was 19 when I was thinking about starting my own
so
business.
So where did that come from?
My buddy Brandon getting killed.
Okay.
I knew that I wanted to do something more. I was trying to and people do this across the world. They turn tragedy into productivity, and it makes the world a better place.
Yeah, pain
so in a way,
and purpose. Yeah.
Brandon passing away was arguably a gift to a lot of people. More his death became meaningful in a meaningless situation. So when we're talking about going backwards, I had some friends. So it's resources, it's helping. And the person that helped me out was partly Native American that was well-resourced, that could help us out, you know?
Right.
And so anyhow, prior to that, I was broke. Prior to that, I was working for a company, and what I'd gone around to the state, and I had helped build a treatment center and helped improve places and so on and so forth. And I had great jobs and bad jobs. I had good experiences because of my own personal stuff going on, and I had bad experiences because of my own personal stuff going on. So I was just your normal average everyday American trying to provide therapy to people to make the world a better place, you know, starting in my early 20s up until, you know, I was maybe 37, something like that. And out of frustration of helping other people and not seeing the benefit of it.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so I'd worked for a company for quite a while, and I had helped them repair some of the damage that had been done just over time. And we went from, I think, negative $14,000 to positive $60,000. And this was prior – so this was – the company that I'd worked for, then I was making about $45,000 a year there. But then after that, I was making $1,700 a month doing assessments. And then, prior to that, I was working doing case management. while I started IBHS, actually, I was like, I was also working on my master's degree, which is probably one of the most insanely exhausting experiences I've ever had.
We will continue with more provocative conversation right after an important advertisement. On Spotify, YouTube, Apple Podcast, and subscribe, like, and please share with family and friends that can benefit. See you on the journey. We're back.
Yeah, so I guess maybe to reverse it and skip a little bit, how did I get there? You know, I was born to a married couple, my mom and my dad. I was born in 1979. My dad was making, I think, $3 an hour. We had just bought a home. I think I remember our rent being like, or our house payment was like $200 a month. It was a two-bedroom house. And, you know, all the way up until the age of maybe 7 or 8, I could only say that I feel like I lived the best life any could ever live. I didn't experience poverty from the level of understanding. I was on my big wheel and I was playing in dirt and right. Hot Wheels cars and running around playing with other kids. And, you know, my mom wouldn't let me cross the street. So I had to stay on my own block and, you know, just neighborhood kids playing and doing all that. And then around the age of 7, there was a guy in the community that abused me for a few years. But even in that time, I had positive experiences. Like my grandparents owned a little fishing, you know, resort, a little bait shop and stuff like that down in Missouri. So I'd go run the Ozark Mountains barefooted and catching snakes and frogs and had myself a little frog and turtle farm. And my grandpa took his tractor and dug a big hole. And so I had all these rocks and bridges and all these things built. So while these things were going on, I also had positive things going on. But we were on welfare. Churches would bring us presents. And then at some point in time, I don't exactly remember the age, but my dad then got a job at the railroad. My mom didn't work until my sister, who's a year younger, she finally went to work, I think, when my sister was 6. And then so it was like our quality of life was the same, but we had better shit. You know, we were still living in the house up until I was about 15. My parents they separated, just stuff that was turmoil that was going on. And so my dad moved out, got a place. And then a year later, we all moved in with my dad off of R Street. And then a year later, we found our mansion, which is what we walked in this house. It was it was a 4-bedroom house. And it was, when we walked in, it was probably the nicest house I'd ever seen in my life. We bought it for $90,000. So in my mind, you know, I'm like thinking we made it.
Right.
Like we made it to the promised land.
Exactly. You know,
we made it. No. Well, yes, we did. I want to say my mom shortly thereafter was diagnosed with cancer. I think she was 45 at the time. And she worked her tail off all the way up until maybe 2 weeks before she passed away. I mean, she was yellow, the whole thing. And
Was your parents together then?
Got a divorce after we moved to that house. Maybe I was then my mom, I don't know. You're a kid, you hear shit, you know. But then my mom and my dad got back together because my dad's insurance was better. So they got remarried at the courthouse.
Okay, nice.
And so his insurance covered her.
Right, right.
I think maybe I was 19. I was dealing marijuana and, you know, I did that for about
a
year.
Good time.
It wasn't, having a good time. And then trying to at least, and then my buddy Brandon got killed.
Yeah.
He was 17. I hung out with the brothers, DJ and Brandon. And so DJ was 18, I was 19, and we all hung out. And he got killed over a quarter ounce of weed. So, you know, $40 at that time, he got shot in the top of the head on my birthday across the street from my house. So that was a really life-changing event because I didn't really experience death that close before.
Right.
You know, I'd experienced like great-grandparents or, you know, at that time, no grandparents, but just knowing of somebody that died, but not that close. And it was pretty devastating, you know, when one of your best friends gets shot. And so I went down to Missouri for a while and my mom would send me books on spirituality. And that's one thing I should probably mention is like in the neighborhood that I grew up in, there were a lot of elderly people that like would just come grab us for church.
Nice.
Like always. And we were always going to church. And my parents, I don't know that they ever did, but so I had a pretty serious understanding of what God was and who God was, and I'd get into little competitions and those kinds of things. And so, you know, with I think with some of the difficult things that I grew up with paired with the positive childhood experiences, I at least had hope. Mm-hmm. I knew that I could do something. I didn't get good grades in school. I think I graduated with a 1.9 GPA. But then when I got into college and I actually was fighting for something and I felt there was a purpose, I did way better in school. So,
wow. Yeah.
This sounds like there was an arc when you got into college.
Yeah.
You were fighting for what? Your purpose was
I knew I was going to start a business someday. At that time I thought it was going to be for kids, and then I started working with kids and I realized, nah, no. There's just a lot of things chaotic that happen with kids that I think are completely unnecessary, but you know, you have CPS, you know, potentially, or Child Protective Services, you have potentially Adult Protective Services, substance use counselors, mental health therapists, psychologists, lawyers, doctors, all these groups of people that are trying to make a decision for a family, and just some of the things that I'd seen and witnessed, it gets pretty.
So, Jeremy, you said that the life-changing event was the death of your buddy.
Mm-hmm.
So how did that affect you?
It was the first time I'd ever felt that longing to have somebody around and couldn't. It was the first time I felt out of absolute control. I had experienced feelings of lack of self-control and some of the abuse that I happened as a kid, but this topped it by far. And knowing that, I mean, I walked across the street because I didn't believe it, and I saw the blood on the concrete, you know, and these things that go through your mind, and blaming people that were around that had nothing to do with it. Like, why didn't the restaurant call? They said he was laying there for a number of hours. And why didn't this person call? And why did it take, you know, you go through all this anger, denial, and all the so-called stages of grief or whatever.
Yeah.
And the only thing I could lean to was God at the time. It was the only thing that made sense. And then trying to make something sense out of it. Like, I'm going to do something someday to honor my friend getting killed.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess it took a lot of prep time, you know, so I had went to school and became a drug and alcohol counselor. It was provisional, but I'd worked in multiple settings under the drug and alcohol. And then as my mom got sicker, I drank a shit ton more and got a couple DUIs. I think I was like 28 or something like that at the time. And then I had some really important people and good people in my life that helped me get my shit together. And then I started working in the field again because I'd washed the field. I was done. I was just like, after my mom, I was like, yeah, I'm done. I'm going to change directions and do something different. You know, just was, you know, too much. So then eventually I was talked back into getting back into the field. And so I did that. And then I worked at a case management company for a while, and then I went to work for another company that owned assisted living facilities, and that's where I had helped improve some things. And then after that, then I had that $1,700 a month job, and then I started IBHS. Yeah, and a lot of it really, like, truthfully was like, I don't know how to convince people. You know, I think there's a lot of luck, a lot of God. You know, I think, oh, you know, knowing what your purpose is and leaning into your purpose. There's so many things, you know, and I don't want to, I don't know where we want to go with the conversation, I guess, but you know, there's still a lot of things that, like, I didn't do. I had really extremely unhealthy food growing up, so I have two chronic diseases now. You know, health-wise, then you know, knowing what I know now about finances and coming on the other side of finances, you really realize how much the shit that you buy isn't worth a damn thing.
Absolutely.
It's not worth nothing when you don't have good health or you don't have family, you don't have friends, you don't have those people around you.
Right.
Because when I was in poverty, I had the best experiences of my life, you know, and when you become an adult, you have more responsibilities, and obviously owning a company that has people that are disabled, you have a much, much higher level of responsibility, which creates stress, and making sure that you're following federal laws and Medicaid laws and licensure laws and all those kinds of things. So it's stressful. But to say that, to have that unique experience of freedom, money does not buy that.
Right. Can you talk about this journey you went through, because, you know, you were very fortunate to have two parents initially.
Yep.
And however, there were some tragic events that transpired. You were exposed to a certain level of spirituality and religion,
yeah,
that helped sustain you,
yeah,
in those tragic events.
Yeah.
And you had a pretty good support system.
Yeah.
Can you talk about how that helped you navigate what it took and takes to sustain the kind of business that you've grown,
yeah,
in 7 years?
Well, I mean, my dad had a small business. My uncle had a small business. My grandparents had a small business. But I think the relationship that I have with God is not one of eternity. It's one of the now. I don't rely on God, and I try to moderate my behavior because I'm going to get promised to heaven, because I believe that that's going to happen to everybody that wants it. There's no hell. I mean, what could be worse, right, than here? You know, so, I mean, every nasty, disgusting thing you could even conjure up in your mind happens in reality here, which, so anyhow, so my relationship with God is one of here and now, being mindful that I've got a partner walking with me that does things for me actively and gets me through times of stress and difficulty and remembering. And so it was when I was going through those tough times or going through the bad situations, I had to remember that there's a greater promise. There's a greater purpose. These things are going to prepare you for what your purpose is. And so that's early on. When I was a kid growing up, you know, a lot of like some of the abuse that I experienced as a kid was like, it was like a, when kids are experiencing things, I think probably under the age of 14 or 13, you don't know how to moderate it in your mind. It's not a matter of relying on God. It's an experience that you're having that feels bad and dangerous and scary and those kinds of things. But as I conceptualized what my higher power was, and the further that I got along, the more I realized that God was a partner doing things for me along the way. And you know, some people have different expressions or beliefs of how God interacts in their life, but I heavily believe that God. So when bad things happen, even now, you know, I know that this is just a temporary thing. That this is this will pass, and that you know, even when Brandon died, I wasn't angry at God. Mm-hmm. I had known enough about God that, you know, I believe there's a, I don't know how far to go into it, but I believe that our lives are predestined, that we come here and we're going to meet the people. Now, it's a tree. It's not like it's one singular path. There's lots of, right, different pathways, right, it can go. But for the most part, your lessons that you have to learn here are predetermined. And once we get here, these are lessons that we're going to learn. And so what I think one of the things that can be most compelling is for people to create productivity out and purpose out of tragedy, because then you don't let the tragedy continue to affect you and victimize you day after day after day after day. If, right, you can find some sense of meaning or some sense of purpose. Yeah. So that's why, one of the reasons why I decided to work with kids early on was because I was hurt as a kid. Plus my friend was in foster care when he got killed. Yeah. His mom had a severe mental illness. And so I was thinking, wow, I'm going to work with kids. Well, you know, I can attest that God does exist, because the plan that I had was not the plan God had.
Right. So,
can I say that, yeah, it was very important? You said something there about the God here and now being present in our lives. And I know we're in a society and religions that push God as do these things and be this way so you can get to a certain place.
Yeah.
You know, in afterlife, that type, yeah, of thing. But you said something that's very important that people need to hear is that you operated on in your life and your belief system is that God is present, he's here and now.
Yeah.
And is your partner in your decision making and your success that you have now.
Right.
And that has been in your life at an early age.
Well, I hope I don't, yeah, and it has. And I hope I don't confuse people by this, but being mindful of the here and now and worrying about the future or worrying about the past is you still existing in the here and now from a different perspective and a different position. Mm-hmm. So if you're worried about the future, you're still here now, worrying about a here and now that may never come.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so if you, and it takes a lot when you're scared to work through those thoughts, but you have to work through the thought from the mindset, I am here and now. And if you have a belief system of some sort of higher power that you know that you can get through the here and now. How do you know if you can get past the here and now later? So you're worrying about a situation in the future that you may not be able to get through. We'll just get through today.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So before we wrap up this portion, I just wanted to kind of circle back around.
Yeah.
From the impetus behind going from you wanting to deal with substance abuse mm-hmm. based upon what happened, I guess, mm-hmm. from your friend.
Yeah.
And then now you're dealing with severe and persistent mental health clients that most people don't want.
Right.
Yet you want them.
Right.
You take them in with open arms.
Right.
What happened to get to that point, to this point?
Well, so again, it's a God thing. You know, like I said, my plan didn't always match God's plan. But I think the thing that really shaped the strength that I have in the mission and the vision and the values and then my own purpose and all of those kinds of things ties into the belief that everybody is good. Everybody has something to offer. And if we cannot deal with the most disenfranchised groups of people in our country or in the world and we just throw them away, it's a testament to how weak our humanity truly is. And Martin Luther King said one time, it's not the evil in the world that scares me, it's the appalling silence of the good. And so I wanted to be as loud of a speaker for the most disenfranchised group at the time. I'm not saying there's not other groups of people.
Right.
Clearly there are. And I hate always having to qualify myself with that, but people do live in a state of victim stance, however your articulation is of your intersectionality, people want to grasp onto the victimness of their intersectionality. And that's okay. You can do that. But you also don't get to steal the victimness of other people.
Right.
And just because you have been victimized does not mean that other groups and other people haven't been. And while you might be the most victimized person in the world, that is your shit to get through.
Right.
And so to get back to your specific question, if I can help the people that are considered detestable on some level or stigma, you know, mm-hmm. prejudices and all those kinds of things, mm-hmm. I believe that I am trying my best to be the best son God could have ever made. I want him to be proud.
Was there a defining moment that made you come to that realization to make that change? You know what I'm saying?
Because it wasn't an abrupt change. It was because after I'd worked in substance use and I had talked to some people that were talking to me getting back into the field, because it wasn't just about the counseling techniques or the stuff that I could do really well. It was the other stuff that I could do really well and how I could contribute in different ways and in other ways with other populations. And so that was my buy-in. Okay, well, now I'm going to go start working with people, doing case management with people with severe and persistent mental illness. And it opened me up to a whole new world of understanding that beyond what we are taught in books, there are more prejudices and stigmas that happen. And there are such good people when we're working day to day. And how many times have you told me, you look at their assessment, you read their assessment, and then you have them in group and you're like, damn, this is not the same person.
Exactly.
It's not. And so I'm not saying that there aren't behaviors that are unexcusable, or I'm not saying that there are things, and I'm not blind to some of the things that happen. However, if we ignore a whole group of people, you can expect that whole group of people are going to start to do worse and worse and worse and worse and worse over time. They will. But
isn't that the case with,
yeah.
I mean, with the case with someone who may have diabetes, if they don't get treatment,
it gets worse and worse and
it's
worse.
It's going to get worse.
Yeah.
But then it seems like that's okay.
Acceptable.
Yeah.
But this person who's screaming and talking to themselves, they need to be locked away and throw the key away.
Well, the thing is human beings have this tendency to believe that they're fucking much more brilliant and smarter and innovative and original. And no, this behavior of being prejudiced towards other people is archaic as it can get.
Yeah.
And you think somehow or another that we're here today in 2024 and it's a new world and these behaviors and these things don't exist and how people will argue systemic racism doesn't exist. Well, the system, it may not be, but the participants exactly. of that system could be. Exactly. And so therefore, vicariously, the system becomes defective because the arbiters and the narrators of the system are racist. So therefore, the system becomes a racist, prejudiced right. environment. Right. So yeah. whatever. So arguments are so crazy. But anyhow, when we're sitting down talking about, you know, the group, it's called a paradigm shift. And that's the only thing that I could say that happened. I understood more than I had prior, and I had opened myself up to that paradigm shift by intentionally getting to know other people, intentionally reading books. You know, Queen Noor wrote a book about Egypt, and the whole story was beautiful, and how she told the story of Jordan. Mm-hmm. And the way she articulated her sentences, you can see the sands and the waters of Jordan, and you know there's so many, and it just brings wonder to your mind about what else in the world are you missing, or what cultures, food, the coffee, you know, that's there's grit at the bottom, you know, there's so many things, there's so many foods, there's so many things that each culture can bring to celebrate. I mean, it's crazy to me how 90% of white people in America love the fuck out of Mexican food, but they don't want you to come across the border.
Right.
You better not exactly. do that.
Exactly.
You know, and I understand legal and I understand criminals right. and yeah. blah, 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 yeah. blah. But it's like, it's this weird back end racism that we think that we've changed. We haven't.
No.
And so to me, for me to demonstrate as a good son to God or whatever you want to call it, I'm doing the best that I can, even though I've made very bad mistakes in my life.
Yeah, but what you're doing, again, I don't want to gloss over what you're doing, Jeremy, because right. you have almost the entire spectrum in mental health in your facilities.
Yeah.
People who no one wants.
Yeah, literally.
Literally. I mean, when you read the intake, it's like most people just by reading it going, oh, no, not that motherfucker. You know what I'm saying? Oh, yeah. Hell no. It's too much. My staff can't handle it. I don't want the liability, the risk. It's too much. I'm not going to stay up at night trying to manage and deal with all this and make sure that these people don't fuck up my place and cause me to lose my mm-hmm. license.
Right.
Yet you don't give a damn.
Yeah.
For the most part.
Don't give a damn. I'm sure he.
You don't give a damn about.
I care about it, but it's a cost benefit analysis. What can right. so there is high liability. I mean, there's things that happen that are in your control and out of your control. Like nobody has died at IBHS yet, but it's going to happen, and so there people are going to be mad at me, and people are going to blame me, and part of that carrying that weight is part of the responsibility that we're all asked to do when we do something good.
And that's
when
we're in a dark world, though.
Yes, yeah. When we're in a dark world, everybody knows this. There's trolls and haters everywhere,
right.
and or people that don't want to understand, or people that can't understand.
Right.
And so you go out into the world, and let's say that you are going around and feeding the poor, and you serve one bad lunch that causes E. coli or something in some kid. You're the darkest evil person on the planet. You're going to hell.
Mm-hmm.
But that's maybe a bad example. But when you go to feed the poor, don't think that you're going to feed the poor because and that's what you're. That's what your weight is to carry. No, your weight is to carry the hate, right. the devil in your ear.
There you go.
The ones telling you're a loser, you're a failure.
Exactly.
You lost somebody. Somebody died on your watch.
Exactly.
You know, the news and all of the things that come down. That right. when I asked to carry the mantle of God, that's what I was asking to carry.
Right.
That weight was not just all of the high fives and the greats and the acknowledgments and all these things and trying to put myself on the news for good reasons. No, the good with the bad.
Right.
Exactly. And it's a heavy, it can be a really heavy weight, but it's the support systems that I've built around me and the people in the community mm-hmm. and the people that do have understanding and that yeah. know that things happen and they say, nope, keep going. This mm-hmm. is just another thing. You got to keep moving. You're doing good, you know? And so it helps me to have people around me like you guys to say, no, dude, you got to keep going.
Exactly. I think we're at a great point.
Yeah, that's a great point, though, to have that support group around you, because the other question is, how do you just maintain the focus and the stability or the mental stability just to continue your vision?
Yeah, there's a lot of ups and there's a lot of downs, and I'm really heavy in my anxiety about how I move around in my company and when I work with other people. And, you know, I would say that there's somewhat of a perfectionist in me. There's somewhat of a people pleaser in me. And so, you know, a combination of things, you know, if this were just about money, it wouldn't have ever lasted. It's about a greater good and doing more than what we originally, like, I would have never, like, if you said, Jeremy, bet on your success, I'm like, I'd have been the guy that probably blew all of his money till retirement and ended up in all folks home living off Medicaid. That would have been my gamble, you know, because that's what my brain tells me to say. But you have to go above and beyond what your brain tells you to say and get into what God has in store for you. And I'm not an evangelist by any means. Everybody has their own way and their own life and their own things to do and live. But what I can tell you is that if you truly, truly, truly believe in something and don't quit, you will make something happen, period.
Right. And you say you're not an evangelist, but actually you're changing lives.
Yeah.
You're changing lives. So we're at the end of our program.
What I think I'm doing is I'm changing how people see how they see themselves.
Nice.
I don't like the idea of me doing something for somebody else because that I'm stealing their work, but I create a platform and a system for people to be able to see themselves. And people get into, you know, what treatment modalities are you using? The treatment modalities are great. How many hours a group are you doing? Great. No, it's the kindness that you extend to the person. Mm. It's the love that you have for them. It's the authenticity that you bring to the relationship that can help change lives and not giving up on people.
What you just mentioned, they don't get. They haven't
got. But that creates the platform for people to see themselves beyond who they originally thought.
I mean, you know, prior to them coming into a facility. Yeah,
but I'm not the only one that coaches do these, principals do these, doctors do these, all these kinds of things. So if you want to bring success to people, bring kindness.
Exactly.
Well, that's huge. That's a good note to end on. And Jeremy, want to thank you. We know you're the host of the show, but what people did get to know a little bit about you today and that they didn't know and that you're doing phenomenal work. You're a phenomenal human being. And I think that's important.
I appreciate it. Genuine, very genuine.
You know, genuine. And you're touching a lot of people's lives in a positive manner.
Thank you.
So, we'll take us out.
I don't know what to say, so you take us out.
I don't know
what to say.
Please join us. HDMI or hiddenbattleshdmi.com. Like, subscribe, and something else.
Like, describe.
Follow us.
Come on. All right. Thanks for joining us today. This is a phenomenal show. Continue to listen and share this with a family member, a friend, or someone in need to experience this message. This is a powerful show today. I want to thank you, Jeremy.
Thank you.
Thank
you for giving me the opportunity, too.
Yeah.
Opening yourself up to a lot of people. And those going to be inspiring for folks.
And, hopefully, you know, he's given an example of vulnerability because it's when we're vulnerable, we really share hearts and we break those barriers of perception and instill hope. So go to www.hiddenbattlesdmi.com. Subscribe, like, follow us, and we'll see you soon.
Take care.
See you on the journey.